This question is related to hastening while awaiting and repolarization for revolution. I think I've inherited some positivism in terms of envisioning what a revolutionary situation would look like. I'm trying to get a picture of the combination of factors, both subjective and objective, while breaking with this idea of, well, you just go out and struggle with people to become class conscious, and then you await something happening, and then people automatically respond in a certain way, and that affects something over here, and then you have a revolution. I'm trying to get a more concrete picture of how the subjective element becomes the thing in combination with objective factors. Could you speak to this?
Well, I think it has, you know, this question of hastening and waiting, and, you know, Lenin said that there were three elements that went into, have to go into an insurrection, or, you know, revolutionary struggle for the seizure of power, and he was speaking particularly about imperialist countries. One is that it has to be based on an advanced class. In other words, you, in order to actually bring about a complete change in the system, you have to have a class who represents, you know, at least an embryonic way or in a fundamental way, a whole different way of organizing society. In different epochs, that's different classes, but at this epoch, there's only one class that can do that, it's the proletariat. But you have to base it on that class, not in a, you know, narrow sense or an economist sense, but fundamentally you have to base it on the reality of that class, and but more than that, on the fundamental broadest interests of that class and on the outlook of that class. But, you know, it has to be based on an advanced class, he said. Second of all, it has to be based on a revolutionary people. It can't be the act of small numbers of people acting in isolation, you know, which is the equivalent of terrorism in effect. You know, acting in the absence of, and then, you know, by the logic of things, actually in opposition to bringing forward masses of people to fight for revolution. So you have to have a revolutionary people, which actually constitutes millions of people. And then you have to have, he said, you know, the third condition, he says, is a revolution or an insurrection depends on that turning point in events. And this has to do with my point about the parachute closing up at the time of you know, the revolutionary crisis, that turning point in the development of things, where, as he put it, all the weak, half-hearted, and irresolute, in other words, not firm, friends of the revolution are paralyzed politically. I spoke to that in the earlier talk about, you know, basically all these other programs have been tried out by masses of people, not by a few, by masses, have been tested in one way or another and found fundamentally lacking. So if you get those combination of those three factors, now do we passively wait for that? No. There are two things that bring that will bring that about at a certain point, whenever it happens in whichever country. One is the overall development of things in the world, most of which is largely not at our initiative, although we may do many things in response to it. For example, we did not decide to have the war in Iraq. That was decided by the imperialists. But we responded to their decision and their motion toward that, and then their carrying out of it, together with many other people. And we responded, or we should have responded, and we need to learn increasingly how to respond more fully from the point of view of our revolutionary and strategic and largest objectives, even while uniting with many people in opposition to that who are not yet at that point and who don't share our fundamental viewpoint and objectives. But largely, you know, there's these things that happen in the world, either social, directly social things, or natural phenomena interacting with social things. Hurricanes are not caused by the ruling class, but what or the system, but what effect they have on human beings goes through the social and economic system and the political system. See, all the interaction of people with nature goes through the medium of whatever the existing production social relations are in the existing superstructure. And then you act upon that. So where does our, and the question is, while on the one hand, things are mainly happening independently of us, where does our initiative lie? How, both in terms of how we respond to what happens, which in its impulse, if you will, is independent of us, and in response to things that we ourselves might initiate by making an assessment of what will drive things toward our objectives. And that's where the dialectical relation between the objective and the subjective factors comes in. In other words, what do we mean by objective and subjective? Objective we mean is out there, you know, not caused by us. It's out there, you know, beyond our immediate initiative and control. It's objective to us. The world out there, things out there, that's objective. Subjective is what we as the subject do. What we as the active conscious forces do. What we understand and what we do. You know, when you're, go back to sports, when you're playing baseball, of all things, or let's take a better one, soccer. When you're playing goalie in soccer, and the other team is coming down trying to score a goal, and one of the other players on the other team kicks the ball toward the goal, that is objective to you. That ball coming at you. That didn't happen at your initiative or by your choice or design, but you now have conscious initiative in how you respond to that. Now, there are certain limits on what you can do. You know, if you're way over on one side of the net and it's going to the other side, you may not get to it, but you do your best to respond to this objective thing that's out there coming at you, in this case, the soccer ball kicked by an opponent. Well, there are all kinds of soccer balls coming at us. You know, and we're not just trying to prevent the other side from scoring, but that's the limit of the analogy, okay? So, you know, we're the subject. We're the conscious element trying to act to change this. And therefore, we have to understand the nature of it in order to correctly act in relationship to it, to change it in the way that is possible and desirable to change it from the point of view of our objectives. So, but the thing is, if you don't understand, you know, material reality, you don't deal with objective reality, you're not a materialist. Materialism just means, in a philosophical sense, that you understand there is objective reality independently existing independently of you and your thoughts or other people's thoughts. You know, it gives the answer to that question. If a tree falls in the forest and there's nobody to hear it, does it make a sound? Well, yes. It creates sound waves. Whether anybody hears them as sound is another story. But yes, it falls. Yes, it creates sound waves. That's materialism. That tree, its falling is objectively real and true. It's out there. It happened. So if you're a materialist, then you perceive that. But you have to be... What does it mean to be a dialectical materialist? What does dialectics mean? It means you understand that things proceed, that matter exists in the form of motion. It's always moving and changing, and that it consists of and moves through contradiction. That it's made up of contradictory aspects. That it's not all one thing or one way. It's not static and unchanging. That it's contradictory within itself and that it's in conflict with other things. You know, the motion of a ball going toward a net is a contradiction. It's moving from one place to another, but it's also, if you break it down, it's in one place and in another while it's moving toward you. That's the character of motion. And Engels pointed that out. Motion itself is a contradiction. Okay, so why am I going to all this? Because what is our role here? Our role is to grasp the dialectical relation, the contradictory nature of the relation between the objective and the subjective. They are separate, but they also interrelate with each other, and they can be changed from the one into the other. What do I mean by that? If we act on, let's take the example someone gave of driving out the Bush regime. Well, the Bush regime is an objective thing. Not a good thing, but it's an objective thing, okay? It exists there whether we want it to or not. You know, whether we choose not to believe that it's there, it's still there, okay? And whether we choose to believe it's doing the things it's doing, it's still doing them. So that's objective to us. Now, by driving it out, if we succeed in driving it out, we are changing reality in a significant way. We are taking it from being a regime to not being a regime. We are interacting with it. And by what we are doing, we are bringing it more into the realm of subjective for us. Because it's out here, we're acting on it, but by acting on it, we are bringing it into the realm of our conscious initiative. And we are changing it. And then we are changing the larger objective reality of which it's a part. We're not just passive here. If you succeed in driving out this regime, you change the whole character of things going on in the world right now. It's not the same thing as revolution. It's not that there won't be terrible things coming right back behind it with a vengeance, but you are changing the reality. You are interacting with it, you know, from the, taking you as the subject, acting on it, or changing it. And by interacting with it, you are bringing it into the realm of your conscious initiative, even while it still has an objective existence outside of you. That's a contradictory nature of that. So your conscious initiative, your action as the subject can act upon and transform that objective reality and bring a new reality into being. But there's the inner penetration between the two. It's not like the objective is over here and there's no connection between it and the subjective. And the objective is absolute and the subjective has to be completely slavish toward the objective. You are interacting with it, changing it. You are taking it from being outside the realm of your conscious initiative to being influenced by your conscious initiative and to being changed in the process. And this is what you do with, you know, what do we have to do? We have to identify once again at any given time, looking at the world as a whole, what are the major concentrations of key contradictions in the world, which by acting on, we can move things toward our revolutionary objectives. That's what, by the application of the scientific methodology, we can determine and then go to act on. We may decide there's certain things that are really important, but we don't have the ability to act on them now in any significant way. We cannot bring them into the realm of our subjective initiative in any significant way. But there are other things that we can, and by acting on those, we can influence everything, including those things that we previously couldn't influence. It makes it, you know, this sounds abstract, but it may, just look at what would happen if we drove out the Bush regime. Let's take it from the realm of the abstract to the very concrete. I mean, everything that people were now saying is impossible would look different. But it doesn't happen by forces outside of it. It has it by us acting subjectively to mobilize other people to make it happen. And then, you know, just step back and think about it for a second. The whole political terrain, I mean, a mass upsurge changes what sections of the bourgeoisie can't or won't change. And all of a sudden, you know, Al Sharpton is a leading proponent of the Democratic Party instead of a candidate declared to be irrelevant in advance. These are the kind of changes that would come about. If you actually succeed in this, they, you know, may not be Al Sharpton, but they have to find somebody who could speak to this mass upsurge to say, okay, we heard you now, come on back over here. So, you know, it would change everything. Not everything, everything, but in a certain sphere, everything, okay? And that would get us, if we are approaching it from the point of view of our strategic revolutionary objectives, that would get us closer there. Even while other things in response to what we did would try to push us farther away. That's the way it goes. Resolve certain contradictions, new contradictions emerge. Transform some necessity, new necessity comes to the fore or gets brought into being. This is the ongoing process. But if we're proceeding, if we're doing two basic things, proceeding from our strategic objectives and then looking at what are the key concentrations of contradictions in the society, in the world, that we can significantly act upon and by so doing can change the whole equation, if you will. And then we go to work on those things and actually change them. That's how we hasten. And when that comes together with things that are still yet beyond our sphere of initiative, and it all comes down and you get those kind of three conditions that Lenin's talking about, that's when you have an opening to go. And you have to always be hastening because you don't know when that might happen. You can't predict all the things. You can't predict a Hurricane Katrina. You can't be sure what's going to happen when they invade Iraq, what's going to come forth in response to that. You can look at it and say, these are some likely things, but you can't know for sure. And there is a role of accident in all this. You know, different things intervene that change the equation, you know, unexpectedly. I mean, again, Katrina is a key example of that, but it's hardly the only one. You know, there were all these tsunamis and everything, and had the communists been in the position to work in response to them, they would have been able to change a lot of things off of that. The more they were able to affect it, the more they would have been able to change things. So these kind of things are constantly happening. You know, something gets exposed for some reason. You know, I mean, one after another, these horrific outrages have been exposed about what the Bush regime is doing, and it hasn't yet called forth the kind of response that it should. But that doesn't mean that the next time something happens and it all kind of merges together, that it won't happen, all of a sudden there won't be a big eruption. Especially if people got the sense that there were more possibility of doing something about this for a combination of reasons. Both they got a sense for because of conflicts within the ruling class that the regime was now more politically vulnerable, and because they got a sense that there was more something coming from below which might be able to do something about that, and through the combination of that. So this is the way you keep working on this, because you know that A, this is the way you can change a lot of things, and B, you know that there are going to be things that you don't know that are going to enter into the picture, and you're not going to be able to maximize what you can do about them if you're not hastening while awaiting in this kind of way.